Good afternoon. I am opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Tuesday, February 25th. We have four items on our agenda. I don't see the bill sponsor yet for the public hearing, so I'm going to move to work sessions first. We'll get some business done. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 1528A. We've already heard this. Legislative Revenue Office, what, tell us where we are in the process.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1528A, again, this is just the annual reconnect bill this committee sees each session. And we don't have any amendments in front of us, so just the engrossed version. The paperwork is there, revenue impact and the fiscal impact statements are both minimals.
And is this one of those bills that we spent just about the least amount of time on so far?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
There were a few questions.
Did have the Oregon Society of CPAs, again, during the public hearing. But yeah, that was part of the discussion in this one was they give the background, the general background. But again, it's up to the committee if there's something of a federal change or something related to a disconnect. But otherwise, it's for the most part just moving that date up 1 year in the connection statute.
And I don't recall any concerns being raised during that hearing.
Chair Nathanson, I move Senate Bill 1528A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Marsh moves Senate Bill 1528A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Let's have a roll call vote, please.
Rep. Hernandez.
Aye.
Rep. Kinney-Geyer.
Aye.
Rep. Owens.
Absent.
Rep. Smith.
Absent.
Vice Chair Marsh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rushing.
Absent.
Chair Nathanson.
Aye. Motion passes. There's no other business on that one. We need a carrier. I'll assign a carrier by the end of the meeting. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1528A. And I still don't see who I would expect to see for 4151. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 4057 and House Bill 4153A. We have had a public hearing on these two bills. It's posted tonight for the purpose of discussing amendments. We've had lots of testimony on the base bills, but there were amendments that had been prepared. And I'd like to hear from some specific people about just describing the intent behind those amendments. And we have a member with us, Representative Evans. Would you like to come tell us about your amendment? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and talk about this bill. I have a couple of comments about the amendment that I proposed originally, and really the background for why the committee passed the bill in the form that it's in. There's recognition in this state that the state of Oregon has a love-hate relationship with gambling through the lottery. We recognize the value of the money, but we're always concerned about the impacts on people that that gambling can sometimes provide. And for the record, I'm Paul Evans, Representative House District 20. It's been a long day. I keep forgetting to say that. The frustrations that we had really were in three pieces. The first piece I think the bill deals with as far as the fact that the legislature has an ability to put down some markers and some boundaries for the Lottery Commission in certain cases. The second had to do with the scale of operations that could or couldn't be put into place without legislative approval. The third was just the impact of the harm that could be caused. Now, I understand that this hasn't taken place yet, but at the time that we were first informed of this ongoing sports betting game, the limit for gambling was a $250,000 a day limit. Now, I understand that through some policies that has been looked at, and I understand that that has never actually taken place. And when I asked specifically what was the biggest at-risk bed, it was somewhere around $11,000. For me, I come from a small community where $250,000, that's a house. Maybe not a pretty house sometimes, but it's a house. It's not something that you gamble away, because if you're gambling that amount of money and lose it, you're going to have some serious consequences. So I drafted a bill that basically said, let's put a daily limit of $15,000. I went a little bit higher than the $11,000, but a limit so that people, they may have to lose their car, but they hopefully won't lose their house. I'll tell you that, quite frankly, this whole particular issue has been very frustrating for members on the Business and Labor Commission. At least I know for several of us that were involved with this bill. When it comes to authority, there's two ways to look at authority. There's the Army version, where you are authorized to do certain things and you're only authorized to do certain things, and that's what you do. And then there's the more creative Navy Air Force version of the rules are basically everything, you can do everything but those things that they say you can't. And my experience with the Lottery Commission, again, for all good purposes because of their charge, I'm not trying to say anybody there is not doing the best they can, but in many ways, they're compelled to try and play the second version of if it's not specifically prohibited, we're going to try to make it happen, which is why we went with the dash ones and why I actually believe that the limit is still necessary. So that's a really long-winded way to say thank you for considering my amendment. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Evans?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be really clear because we heard other amendments last time. This would further restrict in general. If we had a lot of people come up and talk about trying to fight gambling addictions who are very concerned about any bill that might expand, my understanding from your amendment is that it further restricts and that the gambling recovery community would probably be in support of your amendment.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, I believe that is the case. Now, I noticed that dash sixes were listed today, and I don't know the will of the committee. I know that we considered those and actually chose to go with the dash ones because, going back to the philosophy thing, we wanted to make sure that we could certainly support what was going on right now, but we were trying to ensure that we had very clear boundaries about what would not happen in the future precisely because of the communities that you just mentioned.
Yep. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. To your knowledge, does the lottery have the ability to implement this? I mean, I'm assuming they track wagers in relationship to mobile, with a distinct mobile identification.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, let me put it this way. I'm pretty certain that the lottery can find a way to get anything they want to get done accomplished. In this particular case, of the changes that the three of us suggested to the lottery commissioner, this one seemed to be the least technically a problem, at least in our conversation. That was my understanding of the conversation. I'm not a techno geek. We all know that's very true. However, it seems to be that if you can track who is and who isn't gambling, you can certainly track how much they spend in any given period of time. That's my understanding.
Other questions?
Maybe just a comment, Madam Sure. Chair. Representative Evans, I just really want to thank you for coming and balancing all the needs out there, because I know that you, your measure to fund veterans comes out of lottery dollars.
Yes.
And any kind of putting boundaries or caps on it might lessen potential revenue that would come your way. And I know you're balancing out
Yes.
the needs of veterans with the concern that people who may be have gambling addictions might fall into more trouble. So I just appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
I don't see any other legislators in the room right now. Do you see any? I'd like to hear next about the dash seven, which comes to us from Representative Holvey and someone from Representative Holvey's office is here to tell us about this amendment.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Unger. I'm here on behalf of my boss, Representative Holvey, who gives his regards from hearing room E at the moment. I'm here to advocate for the Dash A7s. A little bit of background. So Rep. Holvey was a no vote out of Business and Labor, and he wanted to reiterate, it wasn't necessarily that he had direct issues with the base bill, but he felt like if we were going down this path where we're regulating electronic games offered by the lottery, then we should also be regulating the illegal market that's already operating in the state of Oregon that offers access to fantasy sports through electronics. He feels that by continuing down this path, we will allow consumers to operate in an unregulated venue that lacks transparency, lacks oversight of payouts, and most importantly, doesn't generate any revenue that could go to be used for gambling addiction. And I will note that this amendment's pretty similar to a bill that Representative Hack brought forward in 2017, HB 2549, that we worked on in the Business and Labor Committee that did not move out of committee. So with that, I'm happy to try to attempt to answer some questions if you guys have any.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, again,
please.
Could you explain to me what it actually does?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer. So essentially, it would allow the Oregon Lottery to register and then regulate daily fantasy sports that were operated through a handheld or personal electronic device. So similar to ones that, you know, do fantasy sports, like DraftKings and FanDuel.
You're talking to someone who doesn't know what fantasy sports is.
Yes, you don't even need to pretend. Right. Actually, just talk to somebody who doesn't know.
Yeah, give us the, like, 101, what
Chair
it is.
And so, for instance, I think the largest couple companies, and they may be merging, are DraftKings and FanDuel. And so they allow you to, on your phone, pick a lineup of players and then bet on them. And it's not the overall outcome of the game necessarily, but how those players perform. And right now they operate in the entire United States, and there's really no oversight in the state of Oregon. There's no guarantee on their payouts, if that structure's okay. There's no oversight for the state to really regulate any nefarious activities, if there is any.
I'm going to follow up with a question. Which sports and what level of players?
Chair Nathanson, I would have to do a little research, but I believe almost any sport. I know the most popular ones are the major professional sports, NFL, NBA, things like that. But I would have to check, but I believe it's a pretty wide range of games they offer. And it wouldn't just have to, it wouldn't preclude just those two operators, I would say.
Follow up to Madam Chair's question. Would it include any college sports?
Chair Nathanson, I would have to look and see if they do. Obviously, if we pass the other bill, that would hopefully limit their ability in the same way as that we are trying to do with, mm-hmm. with HB, whatever the other bill that's up.
Representative Marsh, Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple questions just to try to understand this a little bit better. The registration is for the purposes of simply transparency. We're not aiming to make money off of these other entities, but the proposal is to have the lottery itself essentially regulate in some way these.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. So I believe it would give the Oregon Lottery the ability to sort of set how they wanted to register and regulate these games. I think in Section 4, actually in Section 5, I think it would sort of give them the ability to pose a penalty if they don't meet certain transparency measures. And I think we'd be willing, Rep. Holvey would be willing to, move towards anything that gave the sort of oversight that we felt was necessary to, provide, not just transparency, but something that you know, had oversight and essentially provided for, you know, addiction services and things like that. So I think it's somewhat agnostic to how much oversight there is, depending on how the lottery wants to operate.
One more question.
Yes.
It strikes me that this puts the lottery, gives the lottery a realm of responsibility that they've never had before, because it puts them in a regulatory role where they are actually responsible for essentially policing other agencies. So I'm wondering if there was consideration of putting this responsibility someplace else.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, there was consideration. You know, I remember when we talked about in 2017, there are some other logical homes, maybe with DCBS, they would have similar licensing and regulation. I think potentially you might have, I know the state police have a division where they enforce some of these things. I think, you know, Representative Holvey would be open to look at a different body if they want to regulate it, but it just seemed to us that the Oregon Lottery has the best insight into this, and where they're not a regulatory body, they might be the best equipped to be able to regulate this.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, to me it seems like these are two different, out of respect to Representative Hovey, I would just say if this is a goal to regulate fantasy modes, that we bring about a work group or a bill that would do that, just that. And I see these two as two different issues. One where you can bet on single games or certain factors within games, and then another one where I think it's membership, right? You pay upfront to come up with a fantasy team, and then at the end you could win money. It's not like you're betting all the way through or seeing an immediate gain, I believe. I don't play fantasy football or anything like that, so I don't. I know that some of my friends do, and I hear them talk about it, but so to me, these are two different things, and would want to see this fleshed out more, not attached to this issue, in my opinion.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Hernandez, I really appreciate the, you know, you're right, it is sort of two different buckets. And I think the nexus for Representative Holvey is that if we're starting to put sideboards on what the Oregon Lottery can do, then maybe we're pushing people to operate in this unregulated market. But I can appreciate this needing to be sussed out a little more. And, you know, we were sort of trying to recall the efforts that happened in 2017 with Representative Hack around this.
Any other questions? Thank you for being with us. Next, I'd like to hear from Mr. Pack. I would like you to address the notion of your agency having a regulatory responsibility. And then after you talk about that for a couple of minutes, I'd like you to explain to us the -6 amendment that we had seen.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, Barry Pack, director of the Oregon Lottery. As it relates to the -7s, the lottery is not a regulatory body. We have no current authority to regulate gaming other than the games that we offer ourselves. We do have a compliance component of our organization, which looks at our retailers and whether their operations are in compliance with the terms of their contract. We sell video and traditional products through a contract with retailers throughout the state. Those contracts have various terms and conditions. We make sure that through the course of that contract term, the retailers are in compliance with that. That's the closest thing that we have to what I think the -7s put into place. I will say that there are pieces of what the -7s include that are a little bit modeled on some of our other activities. So retailers have to disclose background information around key persons, the folks who actually run the business or have significant oversight of the financial operations and the business operations of the establishment. I think, as I recall, the Dash 7s give lottery the authority to require that kind of disclosure of any potential operator of a fantasy sport. We do that now for our retailers and for our vendors. Oregon State Police do that for vendors and the general managers and other key staff at tribal casinos.
And I realize I have one other question for you. There's a lot of discussion about the dangers of promoting more gambling on mobile devices, and there are bills and amendments related to mobile devices. But why are we focusing on mobile devices, and what is a mobile device? Like, I know this is commonly referred to as a mobile device. There are iPads. There's laptop computers. Well, if you can gamble on a desktop computer, there's no one's interested in that. So gambling in what forms and on what kind of platforms? Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think mobile has become shorthand for digital. And we have generations of people now who do all of their business, all of their information, all of their entertainment on a phone or an iPad or other tablet. But there are also plenty of people who are interested in the same types of experience, but on a laptop or on a personal computer. In some of the language, in some of the bills and amendments, as I recall, we talk about mobile and personal electronic devices, which would also include a desktop computer or a laptop. We're really talking about digital access versus physical access to, like, a printed ticket or anything like that.
Or going to a brick and mortar place to
play a video lottery, a game on a terminal, mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Pack? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I just read an article that showed that you are at a loss for sports betting. Mm-hmm. Can you speak more to that and if that's what we're going to see if we expand it to collegiate sports?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez. The reports you've seen is a budget that is going before my commission this Friday for their approval for the sports program for the remainder of our fiscal year. So it's a 9-month period only. It includes all of the startup costs for introducing a new sales channel and a new product. We have always said from the outset that introducing a new product through a new sales channel would take time to get to profitability, which is why when we put forecasts together, we did a 3-year estimate. So we knew that there would be a period of time where we would have to build a player base. We would have to learn what their betting styles and desires were. We'd have to learn the volatility of sports betting, what our risk tolerance is, and we would be able to grow that over time. We still will grow that over time with or without college sports in the mix. Adding college wagering at some level, sideboards or none, will get us to profitability faster, but the overall product will eventually get to profitability over time.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. I just follow up on the issue that Rep. Evans brought to us, that is imposing a maximum number, dollar figure, for a given 24-hour period, or however we define it. Is that something you considered? Is that presuming that that's not wouldn't be an overwhelming thing to implement?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, a couple of points, if I may, on bet limits in general, but then specifically to your question. Mm-hmm. Just to clarify for the record, there was misreporting in the news media that there was ever a $250,000 bet limit. That's not accurate. the limit was a deposit limit in a bank. $250,000 is the amount, the maximum amount the FDIC will insure on a deposit in the bank. So that was the maximum amount any individual person could deposit that could be available to wager. It wasn't a bet limit or a wager limit. Bet limits are based on the market, so the sport that is being bet on, and the individual type of wager. So if you're betting on an NFL game, the outcome of an NFL game, and you're just betting who's going to win or lose, the bet limits are set on risk to the operator, frankly, right? If it's a simple outcome and it's pretty well determined who the better team is, we're going to set the traders, the people who set the lines, are going to set a much lower bet limit to minimize exposure. Because if you have a lot of people betting on a sure thing win, we're gonna lose out at the end of the day. Our current limits, in our experience, on any individual bet in NFL or NBA are usually around the $3,000 to $5,000 limit. Representative Hovey mentioned a $12,000 or $11,000 bet. That was during the Super Bowl, and that is our highest individual wager. I will say that New Jersey's Gaming Commission recently set a maximum bet limit of $5 million for an individual wager. We are much, much lower than that. In terms of the technical ability to set limits, yes, we can do that. We do that now.
But just to clarify, you don't do that on a cumulative basis, which I think is the point that he was making, that over a given period of time.
Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, that's correct. No, we aren't doing that right now. We allow players to set their own individual cumulative limits, but we don't set them system-wide.
What does that mean to set your own limit? You put something in there, and when you get close to the maximum, you get a warning, and then your own system will tell you you can't.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. We built a number of responsible gambling tools into the app at the outset. When you register, you have to set your own individual deposit limit, daily, weekly, or monthly, so that you can only put in so much money at that point in time. You also have the opportunity to set your own wager limits or loss limits. And again, those can be daily or weekly. And when you start to get to that point, you will get notifications. If you want to increase your limits, you can do that once, and it takes effect, I believe, the next day, so 24 hours later. If you want to reduce those limits, that happens immediately.
Yes.
You mentioned that the state did the $5 million cap. But technically, we don't have a cap, right?
Madam Chair, we don't have, and yet we don't have any individual global cap. We set caps on each individual wager.
Right. So every wager has a market cap, and anybody could gamble. If there's multiple games happening, they can reach the max on each of those. Potentially, in all types of forms. But nothing, if they don't set their own boundaries, nothing is limiting them.
That's correct, yes.
And so it would follow up, sorry. It would be good to hear your opinion on Representative Evans's amendment.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez. Who's specific to the bet limit?
To his amendment on the bet limit, yeah. 15,000.
Yeah. From an operator's perspective, 15,000 might be a little low. We might recommend 20 or 25,000. The idea of a global limit is not something that we would necessarily oppose. I think we would want to talk with our traders about what the market is doing. What play style, as we learn what Oregonians' betting styles are, we'd know a little bit better about what that impact would look like. We're only 4 months in, so we don't have a lot of data right now that would reflect a trend.
that help?
That does help.
Thank you.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding this, since I don't do this myself. We're talking about limits on Oregon either developed or sponsored or regulated games. Someone can still use a personal electronic device, something else that they find on the internet, and be gambling however much they want.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. These bills only restrict those games the lottery offers. It doesn't impact the illegal offshore apps or tribal casinos.
Thank you. Anything else for Mr. Peck?
Madam Chair, you wanted me to address the Dash Sixes?
Yes, please.
Okay. The Dash Sixes are amendments that we worked on at the request of both the Chair and Representative Boshart Davis to provide an alternative that lottery could support. One of the things that we routinely hear two concerns as it relates to lotteries move into the digital world. One is the availability of video lottery style games on a mobile device, and the concern that a player or person could be sitting in their living room in the wee hours of the morning continuing to gamble and gamble and gamble. That is a concern that I share. It is a concern that my commission shares and our governor shares. And we have committed not to offer video lottery style games on a mobile device or a personal computer or a digital sales channel. The response, and then the second concern that I've heard is from our retailers who are concerned about what impact on their business lottery products on a digital device may have. We've all seen brick and mortar companies lose business if a digital channel comes in play. What I have said to them is, in the lottery world, in every jurisdiction in the US and Canada where our lottery has offered products in the digital space, revenues have both risen in the digital space and at brick and mortar. The reason being is the people who want to purchase a lottery product on a digital device aren't going to a brick and mortar right now. So they are attracting new players. And then just general awareness of the lottery product offerings drives additional business at the brick and mortar. I've also told them that I have no intention and my commission has no intention of ever offering video style games, so there wouldn't be that competition. The response I get is, that's great, we believe you and we trust you, but what about the next director or the next commission or the next governor? And so the amendment we drafted was an attempt to codify the commitment that we have made, that lottery would not offer video lottery style games on a mobile device. I don't believe that to be a responsible approach. I don't believe it to be commensurate with the public good. And every day I walk into my office and try to figure out, how am I going to maximize profits and do it in a way that minimizes harm? And I think someone sitting in their home after the bars and taverns have closed with another six pack of beer, continuing to spin again on their phone, is not a responsible way for the lottery to raise money. So we tried to define, and it's hard to see because the language is very technical, because it's about how the math behind the games is used to create the kind of high volatility churn that you see in a video lottery. To define that then and say those can only be offered on a video lottery terminal.
Someone still might find this from an out-of-state or offshore product.
Madam Chair, yes, you will be able to find online casinos regardless.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain line 9 of the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez. What we're trying to get at is what we call the churn in video lottery style games. So I don't know how many of you have ever played a video lottery game, but when you sit at the terminal, you put your money in the terminal, $20, say, and you can wager certain amounts of that $20 on each spin, depending on how many lines you want to cover and what game you're playing. If you win, you get credits, which you can immediately re-wager just by pressing that spin again button. And in the course of the play of that $20, you could be re-wagering $50 to $100 or credits until you decide to either cash out with whatever you've won or save whatever losses you whatever money you have remaining, or you've lost your money and you're done. So this is an attempt to capture that idea of you're not just buying a ticket and then after that Powerball drawing you buy another ticket. It's the immediate and constant re-wagering of those dollars.
Yeah, it's just a quick comment, Madam Chair. It's, to me, it's interesting that this is the way that we have to describe it to be able to prevent that type of gambling on a mobile device. It's very creative.
Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez, we tried many different ways to try to, it's a very difficult thing to try to define. And I'm not suggesting this is the best language, but it's the best we could do in the time we had to come up with an alternative.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peck, does the Dash 6 include video poker games?
Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't believe it does because the math is different in those games than in the kind of real styled video lottery games.
Thank you.
Follow up on that, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't line 9C preclude poker, blackjack?
Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez, that immediate re-wagering would apply, but the way the amendment is drafted, A, B, and C all have to be in place.
Oh, okay. Just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
I wonder, so I imagine that it's written this way to allow for blackjack and other similar games to be part of the mobile application that you all would provide, or can you just, why isn't that on here?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'm really missing that up today.
You know what, don't worry about it.
Okay. I've done this long time, and I don't know when to do that. Representative Hernandez, we were really trying to capture the most addictive games that are on a VLT, and those are those line games that we introduced back in 2005, I think. It wasn't necessarily to specifically allow video poker. Again, my commitment remains the same. Those sorts of games where the churn, the chasing of the jackpot, those are not games that I feel like we should be offering on a mobile device. We had a day to craft an amendment.
So would you say that it's not in your immediate plans to include blackjack, poker, as part of the mobile options?
Representative Hernandez, that's correct.
Anything else?
I think
now we're done.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We haven't heard yet about House Bill 4057. There is an amendment, and I know there's at least one or two people here who could come talk to us about that amendment.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening to discuss the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4057. To refresh the committee's memory, we were asked by the chair of the Business and Labor Committee to work with Lottery on some sidebars to betting on collegiate athletics that would increase the comfort level of the universities with that activity. The base bill, as you all will remember, provides an outright ban on collegiate sports betting. But at the request of the chair of House Business and Labor, we sat down to think through what are some sidebars and parameters. The Dash One amendment would limit gaming on collegiate athletics to Division One sports, would limit any betting on collegiate athletics to the outcomes of matches or games and not individual player performance. And
need some help.
Yeah. There's a few other components here that I'll turn over to my colleague.
Katie Fast with Oregon State University. The other provisions is it would ban both our employees, the athletic agents, and then student athletes and their families from participating. The universities agreed that we would supply a list of those, both employees and athletes and family members, to lottery twice a year. Lottery has agreed, which is in the amendments, to conduct educational activities around gambling for both our employees and our athletes. And then the last section would take 50% of the proceeds and put it into the Oregon Opportunity Grant Fund.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, though, you prefer the base bill and yeah, is that your would that if we had a if you had a choice?
Nathanson, members of the committee, we worked out the Dash One amendment at the request of the chair of the House Business and Labor Committee. We introduced the base bill as it is because we believe it's the right policy. That's correct.
I am noting that at the top of the printed bill, it says, at the request of House Interim Committee on Education for Oregon Council of Presidents.
Correct.
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Yep.
Clearly a lot to think about. The intent was not to be making any motions or advancing either or both of the bills tonight. Is there anything else you want to comment on generally about these two bills before I close the work session?
Are you looking for opinions on where we stand?
Just not necessarily.
Just,
okay. I'm ready. I don't think we need to mention that at this point. Okay, I'm closing the work session on both of those bills, 4057 and 4153A. There's one item remaining on our agenda for tonight. Thank you for everyone who was here to listen to the previous bills. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 4151A. And I don't see a bill sponsor. Has anyone signed up for public testimony? Good. Legislative Revenue Office, will you introduce the bill for us, please?
Yes, my pleasure. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 4151A comes to you via your sister committee, I guess, on energy and the environment. And the bill basically builds on a concept that was introduced in 2017 through the House Bill 2017, the transportation package. And in that bill and at that time in that package, the concept of having an incentive for electric vehicles to be introduced through a taxation mechanism or a funding mechanism that was built at that time on the dealer privilege tax. And the dealer privilege tax is a tax on the sale of vehicles by dealers in Oregon of 0.5% for the price of the vehicle. Now, that in House Bill 2017, that was statewide. In this House Bill, 4151, the introduction is in the format of the metro jurisdictions, or the jurisdictions of the metro district in the Portland metro area. The bill basically attempts to replicate that dealer privilege tax based on the vehicles that will be registered or titled within the metro area, that the sale of those by the dealers will be subject to 0.5% of the price. Now, with all of these taxes, usually when you have privilege tax, because of the parallel venue of buying or bringing a vehicle that is not in Oregon or not in the metro area, there is levied also a use tax. The use tax would be levied on vehicles that are registered in the metro area, however they are bought from outside the state of Oregon. The one note to keep in mind, that at the time of House Bill 2017, the privilege tax was found by the courts later on not to be subject to the highway restrictions in the Constitution. And this one is built accordingly. However, the use tax is a tax on the use of vehicles and is subject to the restriction of highway use. So these two taxes are used differently. Now, the new proposed privilege tax will go to two programs that are already existing as a result of House Bill 2017. And those two programs are, one is the program for the Zero Emission Incentive Fund. And that is primarily a fund to allow for a rebate of $2,500 for electric vehicle buyers. And there is a second program, which is the Charge Ahead Oregon program, also established by House Bill 2017. However, this one tries to offer the incentive for low-income buyers, so their subsidy becomes higher, in the sense that additional up to $2,500, so they could not only buy new vehicles, they could also buy used vehicle, and they would get part of the $2,500 subsidy. So this bill basically pushes both of those amounts to a double of the amount, meaning that each one now, if you live in the metro area and buy one of these vehicles, you could get $5,000 for an incentive on the zero emission vehicles. And if you are a low income individual buying those, you could get an additional $5,000. That will be a total of about $10,000 of incentive for somebody who is buying zero emission vehicles and who is a low income person. These both programs are administered by DEQ, and that's the first section of the bill. Second section of the bill, or second concept of the bill, it allows or requires electric companies to requires them to invest and spend about 5 or 0.5 or 0.5% of their revenues on programs of transportation electrification and incentive in building infrastructure for the electrification of the transportation fleet. However, it also allows the electric utilities or the electric companies to apply through the PUC process to recoup their cost or in investments through the rate paying mechanism that goes through the PUC. And basically, both of them, you know, become effective January 1st, 2021. That's in a nutshell what this bill does.
Thank you. Is there any proponent of this bill in the audience? Someone who we've missed and someone who failed to sign up, a bill sponsor or a proponent? All right, we will move to Daryl Fuller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller here on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association and the Oregon RV Dealer Associations. I'll make three brief points and move on from there. We oppose the bill. There are three concerns that we have. One is the privilege tax was created in 2017, as staff indicated. It is moving from a 0.5% to a 0.5% for most Oregonians, because most Oregonians live in metro areas. So what you're doing is you're doubling a tax that's only about 2 years old. So we have concerns about doubling a tax. Our second concern is that when I started lobbying on behalf of auto dealers in 1996, there was a registration fee for vehicles. Everybody knew what it was. Dealers, large and small, put the registration fee at the end of the sale when they were taking the, and the cost of the registration fee was included in the loans for most customers when they were buying a vehicle on a loan. Well, now we have a sort of a sliding scale registration fee. We have county registration fees, we have a corporate activity tax, we have a privilege tax, and now we have a second privilege tax that all has to be calculated by the dealers in the closing room. Now, the programmers who program the systems we use to make all those calculations appreciate all of these different taxes because we have them on speed dial now to change the software constantly as the taxes change all the time. So the software industry is probably pretty happy. But on behalf of smaller dealers who sometimes don't have the money for these complex systems and in some cases are actually doing this math by hand at their dealership, the more complex these registration and titling processes get, the more complicated, obviously, it is in the closing. And then just finally, as was mentioned, there is a companion use tax to the privilege tax. The use tax essentially evens out the tax for people who go out of state to purchase. We didn't want to make it, you didn't want to make when you passed House Bill 2017, you didn't want somebody to save money by buying from a dealership out of state because they wouldn't have to pay the privilege tax if they went out of state. So you created the companion use tax if somebody purchases a vehicle out of state. Now, when you purchase in-state from my dealers, the cost of that tax is included in the loan when you purchase the vehicle because we calculate it all for you. It's part of the package. But imagine your constituents who find a better deal in Vancouver or Seattle. It's rare, I'm sure, because Oregon dealers have the best deals. But if they were to purchase from out of state from a dealer that maybe isn't aware of the existence of the privilege tax in Oregon, either the existing privilege tax or now the doubled privilege tax, and they go to try to register their vehicle at DMV, DMV is going to say, oh, by the way, you didn't pay this use tax. Before we can title and register your vehicle, you have to pay this $500, $600, $1,000 tax, or we can't register the vehicle. And that customer, your constituents, they can't roll that into the loan as they would have been able to do if the purchase was made here in Oregon. They're going to have to come up with that tax before DMV is going to give them a registration ticket, a license plate. And because these are all, this is a privilege tax on new vehicles, so these are going to be on the expensive end. And even for people buying expensive vehicles who generally are used to rolling the cost of the title and registration into the loan or into the lease, that use tax and for purchasing out of state is going to be something they're going to have to pay out of pocket when they get to DMV. So just some things to think about. Appreciate your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hernandez.
So this, you said double privilege tax. How would it work in practice? Would you just, what would you change in the software besides the rate?
Well, because the double of the rate going from a 0.5% to a 0.5% isn't everywhere in Oregon. It's only, it depends on where you register the vehicle. It's any county of which a part of the county is part of a metropolitan service district. I think I've got the language correct in there. So any dealer that sells vehicles in Oregon that might sell to somebody who might live in a county that part of that county might be in a metropolitan service district will have to, the software will be have to change so that all of those addresses, when they put in the address of where the car is going to be registered, it's going to have to click something that says, oh, you get, you have to pay an extra 0.5% tax because of where you live. Right? And again, all of the out-of-state dealers that don't necessarily follow Oregon tax law, then many of them don't, you know, they don't pay attention to the use tax, or in this case, the use tax that will be either a 0.5% or a 0.5%, depending on where you live. They're going to come into the DMV in Multnomah County, and they get the 0.5% because the dealer in Washington or Idaho wasn't aware that it existed.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. There is no one else signed up to speak. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 4151A. There is no other business before us tonight. This meeting is adjourned.